You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. We're talking about Ryan Howard, Chase Utley, and the impending arrival of Chad Billingsley when we talk Philadelphia Phillies. Looking at the Braves and talking about their offense, their rotation, and the Jose Peraza trade rumors. Talk about the Nats, we'll look at reasons not to worry, look at their awakening offense, and talk about Steven Strasburg. Talk about the Miami Marlins, we'll take a look at Henderson Alvarez, how his injury affects the rotation, and really an in-depth look at that Marlins rotation. We'll talk New York Mets, taking a good long look at the David Wright injury situation and examining Lucas Duda's hot start. Mark, the Braves are hitting .236 with a .299 on-base percentage as a team, and yet they're winning. So tell me, what's going on that this team is off to a surprisingly good start?
Well, yes, they were off to a really good start. And at the end of the day, hey, look, after nine games, you know, considering what the expectations were for this team, you have to be happy with a 6-3 record. But I just have a feeling that the past four games, as they've lost through these past four games, is more indicative of what we might see on a consistent basis throughout the season, where any of the offense had sputtered. You've seen, you know, here's a team that I believe their last four runs have all come from solo home runs. They are not getting on bases frequently. So Monday night, they did draw seven walks. But they're just not getting that production throughout the lineup that maybe they did. They're the first three or four games, and really through Saturday. So the first five games, they seem to get guys on base and come up with a timely hit. You had Nick Markakis, who has been, you know, I think he's hitting .270 right now, and he's been reliable in some run-producing situations. But you look at the top of the lineup, and just last week we were talking about the center field situation. And you look at Eric Young Jr., and he's got five hits in his first 28 at-bats. I believe he's only drawn two walks. You were talking about maybe if you put Cameron Maben in there, and I'll be honest with you, Matthew, I'm starting to lean that way. You know, you can't base anything and make too much out of nine games, but I see enough potential in Maben that if I'm going to take a chance on one of these two guys, maybe I just go ahead and put him in the lineup on a consistent basis, because, you know, he is the better defensive option. We know what Eric Young did last year. If you can get Maben there at the top of the lineup, getting on base just as much, maybe providing a little bit of pop like we've seen out of his bat, maybe that's what this lineup needs a little bit more to serve as a catalyst in that role.
I will say this at least two or three times in every one of our 10 East podcasts for at least the next several weeks. I don't want to make too much of too little information. With that said, you talked a little about walks. There is, after nine games, one Braves player with more than two walks. That means there's one guy on the entire roster on pace to walk more than 36 times this year. I know they wanted to cut down on the strikeouts. I know that they're talking about not relying on the home run as much. If you're going to do that, you got to find a way to get on base. How is this team going to get runners on base?
Yeah, and if you look at this, you know, they have drawn, like you said, they've drawn 25 walks in nine games. Well, 14 of those walks have come, there were seven walks on the second game of the season and seven walks on Monday. Both of those games started by Matt Latos. They did not walk more than three times in any of the other games. And yes, this team is going to have to find ways to get on base with more patience, better discipline than they've shown in the past. That's kind of what I'm leaning towards, saying, hey, look, put Maben up there at the top of the lineup. Maybe he finds more ways to get on base than Eric Young Jr. I think they do need to stick with Jace Peterson in that two-hole. I know that the numbers, you know, people are going to say, oh, he's only hitting 200 or whatever it is through this game. He's the guy that you need to have up there. Just keep giving him a chance. If you want to start making decisions after a month in the season and start looking at the numbers a little bit closer and saying that's indicative of what's going to happen over the remainder of the season, then fine. But let's not draw any conclusions from him. I think he needs to stay there. Freddie Freeman, he is hitting 229, but it's a pretty impressive 229 if you've watched all of his at-bats. I don't know if I can think of four or five outs that have been line drives to center field. If he continues to do that, his numbers will be where they need to be. This is a club that's going to have to not only once they get on base, you're going to have to hit and run. You're going to have to steal bases. And you've seen some of that. And I don't want to, make too much of what we've seen over the last four games from the offense. But it is a feel that is kind of what we expected from this offense, that it would sputter. They are going to have to start to buy into what Kevin Slater has been preaching in terms of not necessarily drawing the walks as much as getting into hitters' counts, showing a little bit more patience. So as we go forward, nine games is not anything. You don't get too excited about what happened in the first five games, six games, and you don't get too disappointed about what happened in the past four, but you hope that the recent offensive woes are not a trend.
What have you seen from the rotation so far? I mean, there's been some good, there's been some not so good. I would seem overall to me that it's a passing grade, but not a stellar grade. Do you think that's a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, I think the rotation is where you really look at how did this team start off 6-1. Well, of those seven games, Julio Teheran, Alex Wood, and Shelby Miller started six of those games. You only saw Eric Stoltz or Trevor Cahill in one of those games, and I think that at the beginning of the season, we've said it. This was a team that the front of their rotation is solid. You match these guys up against most people in the league, and it's you feel pretty good about it when you're going into that game. At the back end of the rotation, Stoltz has been, maybe not as reliable, or I don't even want to say reliable. I actually thought he might be a little bit better than he has been in his first two starts. Cahill, I'm not really surprised what we saw him out of his first outing. At the same time, they will stick with Cahill because they've made the $5.5 million investment with him with the hope that that he can turn things around. I'm looking to see how quickly they make a decision with these guys. If these two continue to struggle with the back end of the rotation, you have to look at Whistler, who had a great start there for Gwinnett the other night. He is the more polished of the two options with him and Mike Fultonevich there at Gwinnett. He's the guy that I think could fit into the rotation at some point here within the next month or two. You look at Fultonevich. He had I think he went 4 2/3 the other night for Gwinnett, but still four walks. His pitch count got up there. The more I watch him, the more I wonder with Whistler here, if Whistler gets into that rotation and Fultonevich, maybe if the Braves feel like, hey, look, we still can make a run at this and they're still alive here down the road, you see Fultonevich, move him into a bullpen role and maybe make that bullpen a little bit stronger and deeper. Because, yes, you have to be encouraged with what you've seen from Cody Martin and Brandon Kniff, but at the same time, can they keep this going? The more the league gets to see them, the scouting reports, are these guys that are able to extend with the success that they've had early here during the early part of their career.
I had somebody pose a really interesting idea to me, kind of putting two and two together when they traded Kimbrel. And the idea was that maybe they weren't directly related, but that one potential sequence of events is that trading Kimbrel maybe at some point ends up with Fultonevich not only in the bullpen, but as the next long-term Braves closer. Do you think that's anywhere in the thought process as they make that deal and as they handle him?
I think it plays it's in the thought process. At the same time, I think they are interested to give Fultonevich another month or two, 3 months, however long that they want to continue to get a feel for where he's going as a starter before they completely ditch that idea. But, yeah, I do think there are people within the organization that are saying, hey, look, we'll give this a try. We'll let him continue to show whether or not he can be effective over five-plus settings. If not, we've seen enough from him that hey, look, if it put him in that closer's role where all of a sudden he can go max effort, maybe not have to rely on as many pitches with the secondary pitches, the consistency with which he throws them effectively being a problem right now. Maybe you cut down eliminate a pitch or two, and he's effective in that closer's role or at least a late inning bullpen role. You know, I will not be surprised. That's what I would say to answer that question, if that one day he is in that role. Because while you say, wow, it's some of the stuff he throws out there, you know, he's a guy that's going to impress you with his stuff. We just have not seen him be effective in that starter's role yet, and you have to doubt or have to have some doubt as to what the future is going to hold for him in that role. But if you can put him in that one inning at a time, maybe he is very effective.
One last thing, we are going long, but I have to address this because it's an interesting thing. It sort of burbled up a few days ago and now seems to have a little more substance to it. The Yankees are apparently interested in Jose Peraza. Now, I'm sure that part of the answer to that is everybody's interested in Jose Peraza because that's a guy that would make most teams better. But can you put two and two together and see some sort of area where there's a fit there, or is that just the Yankees would really love an infielder with that kind of skill set?
I really think that, you know, it is more that right now. You know, is there, am I surprised that the Yankees are interested in Jose Peraza? No, but I, you know, from talking to the Braves folks, you know, I don't sense there is absolutely any interest in trading Jose Peraza. I think this is one of those where, you know, the Yankees are also probably interested in Correa and Lindor and, you know, any other middle infielder with great potential. I don't see anything brewing there right now. I'm going to continue to, you know, I will not completely ignore it because at the same time, the Braves do have some middle infielders coming up. If the Yankees do have a, you know, an outfielder there in Aaron Judge who might pique the Braves' interest, but at the same time, I don't know why. I don't know if this is the time to say that these two teams are necessarily talking as much as, hey, the Braves or the Yankees are simply looking at Jose Peraza right now.
Well, and that showed some signs of life the past couple days, and that had to be encouraging. But excuse me, I want to ask one big overarching question to you to start with. Why should Nats fans not be worried right now? Give me some sunshine. Give me some reason for Nats fans not to be worried about this rough start.
They shouldn't be worried because of their pitching. They shouldn't be worried also because Ian Desmond, for example, is not the player that we saw the first six games of the season. This guy is going to put it together. He did it the last two games, and I expect him to be really to play all-star caliber baseball the rest of the way. So I think everything will be okay, and you know, it's really too early to panic. And believe me when I tell you this: the 1977 Yankees started the season 2-8. Everyone was complaining. Everyone was worried. But they ended up winning the World Series that year. So I remember, I can go back to years where some championship teams got to slow starts and they ended up winning the championship. So there's nothing to worry about here.
The best team I ever covered, 105-win 04 Cardinals, were something like 23-22 in late May. So it's a long season.
Correct.
I did mention the offense coming around, and it did seem like they started making some harder contact the last few days. You see any significant difference in Boston versus earlier, or was it just a matter of hitters eventually hit?
I think it's a matter of hitters eventually hitting. I think what also helped was that it wasn't just Desmond hitting. I mean, Michael Taylor has done a good job. Even though the batting average doesn't say it, he's really the team leader in RBIs. You know, Danny Espinosa so far, so good for him. Dan Uggla has done well. And I think Wilson Ramos is starting to pick it up too. So those guys have to really pick it up.
What's up with Steven Strasburg?
Well, as you know, I can tell you during spring training, it was injuries. This time, I don't know what to tell you because he just had a bad outing. And, you know, Matthew, I really believe that we were spoiled by Strasburg when he first came to the league in 2010. I mean, he was really unbelievable. And I think since that time, we expect him to be invincible, but he's not. And to me, he never was the ace of a team. It was always George Zimmerman in my mind. But, you know, I mean, Strasburg, he's really a good pitcher, but he's not as invincible like everyone really believes he should be, and he never was, really, after 2010.
I want to kind of follow up on that. I want to examine Strasburg a bit because I was having a conversation about him with another friend of mine, baseball fan, and I don't understand why that is because he can make every pitch. It's not location. He locates well. He's got a wide arsenal with just exceptional stuff. He has high strikeout rates. He doesn't walk a lot of guys, and yet, in the end, the pitcher that he is doesn't match up with everything that you see when you watch him pitch, and it baffles me. As somebody who sees him, and I watch him a lot, as somebody who sees him more than I do, what is it? And again, he's very good. I don't want to sell him short, but there's everything there, it seems to me, for this guy to be great, and he's only very good. Why do you think that disconnect is?
Well, I think, you know, also that I think he expects things to be perfect behind him. And, you know, like when things go wrong, when you have the errors, like what happened the other day, you know, he can be flustered. He really can be. And I think that's the reason, too. I think he wants everything to be perfect. And when it doesn't, they just go haywire. And I'm not going to say he gives up, but things aren't the same after it happens.
Two more things, and I will let you go. One, it's even less information than we have on everybody else, but Jason Wirth is back in the lineup. One hit in the early going, but obviously three games won't tell you everything. How does he look? How's he swinging the bat? How's he moving in the outfield? How does Wirth look to you playing ball right now?
Well, it's too early in terms of how he looks in the outfield because he's playing in Fenway. Let me see him play in a regular stadium like Nationals Park before I judge that. In terms of hitting, you know, again, three games, I think he'll be okay when it's all said and done. I mean, the thing I love about Jason Wirth is that he, you know, the guy's pace, a patient hitter, has an on-base percentage that is always high. So I'm expecting him to be that guy the rest of the way.
All right. And then one last thing to wrap up. And it's a big one, but what is up with this team's defense? This ought to be at least a pretty good defensive team. I know they're missing some key guys, but even the guys they're playing ought to be pretty good. Is this, again, just a bad week and a half, or is there reason to be worried about this team defensively?
Well, I have to say it's just about a bad week, but then again, Matthew, you know, last year at this time, the Nationals got off to a bad start defensively. And they didn't really get it together, really, until June. So you hope that doesn't happen again. But, I mean, you know, Ian Desmond was a big part of the reason they got to a slow start last year and this year. So I think everyone is hoping that, like last year, Ian Desmond will have some errorless games and be the all-star caliber shortstop he's been. So right now they're not worried. Matt Williams isn't worried. You know, we're talking about guys who are making these errors. These guys have great characters, and they'll find a way to get it done. Believe me, they will.
Joe, with the possible exception of having to do without Giancarlo Stanton, if there was one thing the Marlins really could not afford earlier in the year, it's to lose Henderson Alvarez. They're already down one starter. Alvarez is not only very good, but gets deep into games. How big a blow from your perspective is it to have to do without Alvarez for any length of time?
Well, potentially it looked like it was going to be devastating because it looked like it was going to be very, very serious and potentially, you know, like season ending. Now it's sounding like it could be more best case scenario, which could be about 3 weeks. So if they can get him back, you know, sometime the first or so week of May, they can weather this. So, you know, that's kind of the encouraging news there. And in the meantime, they're going to have to kind of figure it out. You know, David Phelps is going to get a start, and they brought up one of their top pitching prospects, Jose Urena from AAA. And that kid is right now going to be in long relief, but I just don't see him staying long relief very long. They want that kid to pitch. He's 23. He's got upside. He needs to be starting. So if Phelps does really well, you know, then I think, you know, you can see Urena go back to AAA. If Phelps struggles, I think Phelps could go back to being the long reliever, and Urena could go into the rotation. Either way, it's not the most ideal situation, but, you know, that's kind of where they are right now as they try to, you know, get innings and you know, kind of, you know, bridge those innings until Henderson's ready to come back.
What do we need to watch as far as Alvarez and kind of what's going to determine whether this is on the shorter end, 3 weeks, or whether it's a longer deal?
Well, it's a little tricky because it's shoulder inflammation, and Mike Redman said it was elbow inflammation, but that wasn't exactly accurate. What it really was is a little more mild, you know, just a little mild tightness. They don't seem as concerned about the elbow. The shoulder, he dealt with it a couple of years ago when he first joined the Marlins and started a year on the DL and then come back till June. But what I understand is they kind of nipped this really fast, you know. So this wasn't like, you know, he was hurting. He was even ready to come out and pitch the sixth inning in the day that, you know, he came out, which was Sunday. I think a few more days of, you know, kind of R&R, and then, you know, when he throws a baseball, you know, throwing flat ground. So I think we'll have a better clue in the next couple of days, you know how that's progressing.
What is the long-term level of concern or at least awareness regarding Alvarez's health? I mean, is he a guy that we should sort of kind of have a kind of permanent, not red flag, but maybe kind of a permanent yellow flag on this guy, kind of until he puts a bunch of years in a row, maybe worry about how well he holds up physically?
He's a unique guy. I think we talked about him, Matthew, is because he's like a baseball player who pitches. So he's subjected to injuries that players get because he's diving around the field. He runs the bases well. You know, he can hit. He, you know, springs off the mound. You know, he's fast to first base. He had, you know, potential collisions there on 3-1 type of plays. So he's, along with, you know, the keeping the health of the arm, there are a lot of other moving parts there. So he's a little more unique than your typical pitcher. But I think I said, you know, we talked about that there was a little concern just how hard he plays the game, that he was going to hold up, you know. So it's certainly something to monitor. But I think, you know, this guy is, and now he's mid-20s, been in the league a few years. He's a really, really good athlete, and despite being, you know, apparently flaky from time to time, he's got a really good baseball aptitude as well. So I think he's going to know himself enough to preserve and you know, kind of pull the reins in. As far as if the shoulder is more serious than we think, obviously shoulder injuries are probably worse than elbow injuries. In most cases, that proves to be true. So definitely there. If it's not a red flag, it's kind of a yellow, I think.
You mentioned the one move they already made to bolster the bullpen, but it seems like one of the biggest worries here, it was a worry for the Marlins all winter, was where are the innings going to come from, both before and after Jose Fernandez returns, because even when he returns,
right,
he's not a guy they're going to push hard. So down one of their innings guys, is there any kind of adjustment they're going to make to the bullpen? Are any of the starters going to have to maybe be pushed a little deeper than they'd like at this point of the year? I mean, it seems like there's some degree to which they're going to have to make sure not to blow out the bullpen while they're down essentially their top two starters.
Yeah, you've got, you know, Dan Haren's 7 innings, really, you know, well-pitched game in Atlanta, on Wednesday, huge, because, you know, that's exactly what Dan Haren has been, the durable guy that, you know, not overpowering certainly, but, you know, dependable, the 10 wins, the 200 innings, the 30 starts a year. So that was encouraging. Cozart's going to have to step up. You know, he's starting the series off with the Mets, and he's just going to have to, you know, he's going to have to step up and be a guy that goes deep into games, and they believe he can be that guy, but he's going to have to do it. Tom Kohler, they kind of know what they got there. He's a workhorse. He gives everything he got, but Tom profiles more as a 4 or 5. You know, so, and Latos obviously is going to have to do his part, but Matthew, keep an eye on Justin Nicolino. He's at Triple A, the lefty who got the Toronto deal a couple of years ago. Not the hardest thrower, but he's throwing really well in New Orleans. Last night he struck out Chris Bryant and had some, you know, really ugly swings from the Cubs Triple A team. Pitched really well. He's starting to get some strikeouts. He's starting to miss some back. But he's more of a pitcher's pitcher, you know, just that guy just with mound presence, not overpowering, but lefty can, you know, basically thread the needle. And, you know, he's a kid who at some point may have to come and rescue things for a while. Otherwise, it could be, you know, not the season they're hoping for.
As an aside, it makes me feel unbelievably old when we talk about Dan Heron as a slow-throwing veteran.
I know.
That I saw throwing 94 coming out of the mound.
He reminds us of those days, too, that, hey, I wasn't always this way.
I want to talk, we may end up talking nothing but the rotation, but I actually don't have a problem with that, because I wanted to actually ask you last week about Jared Cosart, who's an interesting guy. I think a guy they're really excited about. What kind of expectations are there for him performance-wise this year? I mean, he sort of technically slots in as like a 4 or 5 back of the rotation guy. Do they think he's got upside to maybe be a 2-3 kind of starter?
Yeah, they really do. It's, you know, it's all going to come down to that third pitch, but, you know, we've talked about the fastball movement and the cut that he has, and that, along with the sinker, the breaking ball, but, you know, the changeup is a pitch that, you know, he didn't have the greatest spring on a number of fronts, but in terms of performance, one of them was, you know, he was getting in trouble throwing the changeup, not having the greatest feel for it. If that pitch can emerge a little bit, you know, it's going to be really, really big for him. But, you know, his competitiveness is just the live arm, the mid-90s fastball with cut. And, you know, they think he's got a chance to be really good. And he's going to have to be it. You know, he would have started the year as number 2 starter. That, you know, would have been Alvarez. It would have been Cosart and then Latos and, you know, then pushed on back. But, you know, he had the blister and the little incident with the gambling. And, you know, there's some uncertainty, and he ended up being the 5th starter. So, you know, here's a guy who they think, you know, until Jose gets back, he's got to be in the upper part of that rotation. And, you know, it's kind of the mystery. You know, if they pitch the way they think they can, you know, they're going to go far. But if it's not as high as if the talent doesn't meet what they thought, you know, they may not go as far. They're going to have to just hit a lot, you know. But Cosart is clearly a guy they're counting on.
And then Matt Latos, who I sort of guess slides into de facto number 1 status for the moment. His second start was better, I guess. It was closer, but still wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
Were they encouraged by his second start? Is it still disconcerting that he's not there, or is it more encouraging that he was closer?
Well, I think, you know, that it is more encouraging that he was closer. It also, keep in mind, the night, a 52-minute rain delay before the first pitch was thrown, and then he was moving along. He had to get up down 2 more times, a 39-minute delay. So, you know, he was holding a 1-0 lead going into 4th, and he had to come back out after a 39-minute delay. So, you know, his defense saved him a bit. The key with him is that downward movement and, you know, getting a feel for that, because he's more of – I'm not looking at the radar gun so much with him as, you know, movement and that kind of spiking, you know, that sinker and, you know, that changeup and those pitches that just break straight down. And with his size, he uses that downward plane to his advantage. Once he gets more feel for that, you know, he's still, you know, he's a guy I imagine, you know, if he doesn't have a setback physically, is a guy considering the injuries he had last year with the knee surgery and the little elbow scope and, October, he's the type of guy that could get better as the year goes on. He certainly has a track record. He's certainly tough on the mound. You know, he's, for all the antics that kind of drive people a little nuts, you know, even from people I heard in Cincinnati, when it's time to pitch, he was a gamer. So, you know, if he could be that pitcher, then that's going to be a huge boost to the Marlins.
What should have been a fairly celebratory situation at Citi Field yesterday ended up not at all, or within the last couple of days, ended up not at all happy as David Wright went on the disabled list. It sounds like this could have been worse. What is, first and foremost, what is the prognosis for Wright as far as time frame, as far as how severe this hamstring injury is that he's dealing with?
Well, he's on the disabled list, so you're looking at a minimum 2 weeks without him. Realistically, it's probably more like three. But you're right, it could have been worse. You know, the thing that kept popping up when Wright was talking about this injury was 2 years ago, if you remember, in August, or even in late July, he kind of sort of tweaked his hamstring in the same leg and decided to play on it. It wasn't that bad, he thought, and he wanted to play through it and wound up really straining it further and missed 7 weeks of the season, missed the whole end of the year. So with that in the back of his mind, David decided to play it safe this time, went right on the disabled list, came out of the game right away, got treatment, and the Mets are hoping that because he took those steps and because he, quote-unquote, learned his lesson last time, it will be 2 to 3 weeks as opposed to something a lot longer and something a lot worse for the Mets.
The immediate roster move was Eric Campbell. Is he going to play regularly, or how are they going to sort of configure the infield while Wright is out?
Yeah, he's the guy. You know, they had a couple options. It was interesting. They could have moved, say, Daniel Murphy or Wilmer Flores over to third base and maybe put Ruben Tejada in the lineup or even called up Matt Reynolds. But because Campbell plays third base and because he was doing so well, I think he was hitting .550 at Vegas, you know, in the first week of the season, they decided to just bring him up, and he's going to play every day. And, you know, it's not – while Campbell's the guy who's going to fill in, it's not really on him to replace David Wright. No one expects him to do that. What people do expect is, you know, some of those other guys in the lineup to step up. They're looking for Curtis Granderson to pick up some of Wright's load and Travis d'Arnaud and Wilmer Flores and all these guys that we talked about all throughout spring training, Lucas Duda obviously being another key one. So rather than expecting Eric Campbell to really come in and be a spark for this team in Wright's absence, they're looking to the other seven guys in the lineup to really pick up that slack.
I may be imagining something. It may just be something I've noticed that other clubs do, but it seems like the Mets have had a decent amount of success with, for lack of a better term, kind of quad A guys. It seems like they are pretty successful at having a decent bat or two stashed away when things go wrong. Before Campbell, I'm thinking of Josh Satin. It just seems like, you know, you're never going to cover for David Wright, obviously. But do you think it's fair to say that in general they often tend to have a decent plan B? Offensively, they tend to do a pretty good job of stashing sort of useful bats at AAA?
Sure. I mean, a lot of this team is built around guys who came up through the system who were not necessarily, you know, guys we talk about on the top prospect list every year. You know, when you look at, say, a Juan Lagares or a John Neese or a Dylan G and so on and so forth, they're guys who are major contributors to this team who didn't get a lot of hype coming up. Campbell was very much one of those guys. Last year, he was totally off the radar coming into spring training last year, had a great camp, really inserted himself into the conversation and almost made the team, which would have been a huge shock out of spring training. He wound up coming up not too soon after that and spent most of the summer up here in Flushing. So, yeah, you know, their hope is that they're not going to, you know, I don't want to say not going to miss David Wright too much, because they will obviously miss him. And like I said earlier, no one expects Eric Campbell to come close to replicating what David Wright is capable of when he's healthy. But the hope is, yeah, you can just sort of, the phrase Sandy Alderson used was plug and play Campbell. Just put him in there, play him at third base, bat him in the lower third of the order, and hope that, you know, he's not a liability so that the other guys around him can really shine.
You had an interesting piece on Mets.com this week just about sort of the mindset and about sort of, you got to win games, and we talk about Harvey, and we talk about Wright, and we talk about stars, and there's narratives. But a contending team, as the season goes on, just has to win games, however it looks and however it happens. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm not a big soft factors guy, but to what extent is implementing a mindset that this is a contending team, that every series is a big deal, every win matters, to what extent is that still going on, or do you think that's already instilled as Terry Collins tries to sort of make a talented group of ball players into a team that's really going to contend for 6 months?
Yeah, I mean, look, these guys see the same things that we see. And while they won't admit that a series against the Phillies, for example, is easier on paper than a series against the Nationals, the truth is it is. And they know that as well as you and I do. And they look at the schedule. They look at who's supposed to be good, who's not. They look at the division. And they don't expect to win every game against the Nationals. You know, if they go 500 against the Nationals, that would be great for them. But what they do understand they need to do is they really need to beat up on the Phillies. They need to beat up on the Braves. To a certain extent, they need to show that they're a better team than the Marlins. These are teams within their division that they're going to see 18, 19 times this year. And, you know, if they can win 12, 13 games against the Phillies, for example, that's something they've struggled to do in the past. Not that they've played down to their competition, but, you know, when they've had a chance to really just bludgeon a team that they're supposed to beat, you know, maybe they've beaten them, but they haven't necessarily won every game they've had an opportunity to win. You know, if they really want to make a run at this thing, and if they want to, quote-unquote, learn how to win, you know, they're going to have to do it against the bottom teams of the league, knowing that they can't win every day against the Nationals, and so on and so forth. So, you know, they showed some good signs with that the second week of the season, sweeping the Phillies. And, you know, if they can keep doing that going forward, that's the difference right there between, say, a 90-win team and an 84-win team. And that's the difference between making the playoffs and not, which is their goal.
You mentioned one of the guys off to a good start, and one of the guys that's going to need to perform while they're without Wright is Lucas Duda. And apparently it's not an issue. Is it impressive or surprising at all that a guy who apparently was very close to sort of being set for life financially and had it not happen has really taken off like he has?
Well, I mean, you can look at that one of two ways, and the way I guess you could look at it right now is that a guy, all of a sudden, you know, he's not set right now, and he knows that he needs to produce. He's in his prime arbitration years right now. He's got a few years left until free agency, so every home run he hits is money in his pocket. Now, knowing Lucas Duda, I don't think he really is looking at it that way. I think he's looking at it as, you know, I just want to go up there and hit as many home runs as I can. But all that being said, I mean, this is a guy who there were a ton of questions surrounding him, you know, in his early days as a big leaguer, over his confidence, over his do I belong, that sort of thing. And Terry Collins said an interesting thing the other day. He said, I think it's pretty clear now that Lucas Duda, you know, has undergone a change in the past couple of years and understands not only that he belongs, but that he's really, you know, you're talking about one of the elite hitters in the National League now. He has a chance to be, you know, one of the top 5 or 10 sluggers in the National League if he can repeat what he did last year. So just that knowledge, that changed mindset, I think has done wonders for him. And, you know, if he can just put that to use on an everyday basis, which he's done quite well over the first 2 weeks of the season, then I don't think he really needs to worry about the numbers or the dollars or the cents or whatever else is going on with his negotiations and all that, because it'll be there at the end of the year. As long as he produces, you know, he's not going to be lacking for money in this game.
It's interesting to look back, and it's almost funny to look back. Duda or Davis was a big question. It was an issue that organization had to face and address. And it appears very much they got it right. Not that Ike Davis isn't a useful big leaguer, because I think he is, but it wasn't obvious at the time externally that they got that right. In retrospect, what do you think they saw in one guy that they didn't see in the other that has worked out so well for them?
Well, not only was it not obvious, I think the vast majority of people thought Ike was the guy. I mean, Ike was a former first-round draft pick who they had given every chance, who had already hit 30 home runs in the big leagues, and they looked at him as you know, this is our guy. And somewhere along the line, that fell off. You know, a huge part of that actually sort of delved into some of the advanced metrics that the Mets used. And the most prominent one for Duda was something called exit velocity, which is, in layman's term, the ball comes off his bat faster than just about any other player in the major leagues, Ike Davis included. So they looked at that, and they looked at the guy's production compared to one another, and they said, well, you know, maybe what Lucas Duda is doing developing as a power hitter is a little more legitimate, only because we're seeing how he's hitting the ball. He's hitting the ball hard, harder than just about anyone. So they took that, and they took a little leap of faith with it, combined with some success that he had against lefties early in his career, which Ike Davis never really had. And they thought Lucas Duda could develop into a more complete hitter. You know, one of the great signs we're seeing out of Duda so far early this season is he really is starting to see the ball better against lefties. He's shortening up against them. He's punching it into left field. He's had a couple doubles already this season that he's really driven the left center field, which is a huge sign. And he's still hitting the ball hard. He hit one home run against the Phillies that went into that section in center field where the seven line fans always sit with their orange shirts. And I mean, that is an absolute bomb. It's hard to get it out there. And I don't think I've seen all that many over the past few years at Citi Field. So, yeah, it was a sort of a scientific look the Mets took at Lucas Duda and Ike Davis. And it certainly seems like they gambled on the right guy because, like I said, if Lucas Duda has another season this year like he did last year, you're looking at one of the top 5 or 10 power hitters in the National League for sure.
Ty, you had a really interesting piece this week drilling a little deeper on Ryan Howard, and I thought it was intriguing because we sort of talk a lot about big picture, and it's kind of obvious to see big picture. Big guy with what Bill James used to call old player skills gets into his 30s. These things happen. But you examined the way he's being pitched, and if I read it correctly, that's almost more disconcerting what's going on, the way he's being pitched, and the fact that he's getting fastballs and he can't hit them seems maybe the kind of most distressing thing of all.
Yeah, I definitely think that way. It seemed early on just watching the games, it's like, wow, he's getting a lot of fastballs. He's really, really getting a lot of fastballs. But yeah, then when you look at the numbers and see that he's getting nearly 60% fastballs, which is when you compare his percentage of fastballs in previous seasons, they were often, you know, under 50%. And the fact that now he's getting more pitches in the strike zone than ever before in his career. So not only are they giving him fastballs, but they're throwing pitches in the strike zone, which to me says they're just not afraid of him hurting them in any way. You know, years after he won the MVP in 2006, next thing you know, this guy was seeing breaking ball after breaking ball after breaking ball, and he would almost never see anything. He would almost never see a fastball unless the pitcher was way behind in the count. But now it's the opposite. They're just going, you know what, we're just going to go at you with the fastball, and we're just going to throw some strikes, and we're pretty confident we can get you out. And yeah, so that is disconcerting going forward that he's getting basically what he's wanted to get for years and years and years, and he's not been able to do anything with it so far.
So what can be done either at player or club level about this?
Well, that's the $60 million question right now for Ryan Howard. Ryan Sandberg said yesterday he thinks it's about adjustments. Howard said he thinks it's about adjustments. Ryan Sandberg kind of indicated that he thinks that Howard has not done enough at the plate. He said, you know, hey, if you know you're facing a guy that's throwing 96, you got to kind of do something, make an adjustment to speed up the bat. If you know the net guy you're facing tomorrow is throwing 89 with some sink, and you got to adjust to try to hit that fastball. And it sounds like he doesn't think that he's seeing enough of that from Ryan Howard. But the one question I asked Ryan Sandberg is, do you see any bat speed or bat speed at all? He says he did, but I think certainly, you know, the fact that he's not able to kind of square around in these fastballs like he once did indicates that the bat speed is slowing down a little bit.
I mean, you know, it's kind of what we do at this time of year, but I don't want to make too much of a week and a half, but you know, there was this hope. Everybody kind of liked the way he was moving in spring training. And I think there was this hope that the way this works is Howard goes out and shows he can still do something and pops a few home runs. And even if he doesn't hit 280, 290 again, maybe hits 250, hits a few balls out of the park and has appeal to some team that has a DH need or a first base need. And maybe they can move him somewhere. If that doesn't start looking like it's going to be the case, and I know it's not this week. I know you don't make a move based on a week and a half, but as this goes forward, and if we get a few weeks, a month or two into the season, and it's clear that Ryan Howard isn't bolstering his own trade value, what directions do they start looking? Do they start thinking about playing him less? Is there a point this year where a release becomes a viable option? Where do they go if this doesn't get better?
I think there does become a point where, you know, the release gets talked about a little bit. It was discussed last year. You know, the Phillies denied it publicly that they kicked it around, but they did kick it around. I think what they're going to do is he's at least going to get the first 2 months of the season. And that's just a guess on my part, but the reason why I say that is because one of the guys that they have that could potentially play first base is Michael Franco, who's down in AAA right now. And he's down in AAA. he's going to be down in AAA for the same reason that Chris Bryant is in AAA, which is team control. You know, if Michael Franco starts the first 6-7 weeks of the season in AAA, they'll have an extra year of team control over him, you know, which they hope will mean something 6 or 7 years from now. So I think they're going to give Howard at least a couple months of playing fairly regularly, although he has only two. He's had twice in 9 games. Has not started twice in 9 games, and both of those at times have been against left-handed pitching. So you might see a little bit of a platoon type of situation. But you're right. I mean, they're not going to do anything with him right now because it's kind of a lost year in the sense that they know they're not going to make the postseason. So they really have nothing to lose by playing him that much. Darren Ruff is a nice kind of complimentary player, but he's not the next star in the making, first baseman star in the making. So they really feel that, you know what, we can actually afford right now just to have Ryan Howard go out there and see if he can get it going. And if he can't, hey, you know what, we gave him a shot. At least now we finally know, and we'll feel a little bit more comfortable about who our first baseman is going to be in the future.
On that same side of the infield, Chase Utley had one big game, hit a couple home runs, and aside from that, both before and since, has also not hit much of anything. You know, again, same caveat as always. We're talking about a week and a half, but is Utley just hitting him bad luck, or does he look not right also?
He hasn't looked as – it's funny that he looked really good in spring training. Like, he was really hitting the ball well going into the season. And he seemed to be one of the guys that nobody was worried about. I still don't think anybody is worried about him, although there has been a couple plays in the field where he has looked a little slower than he has been in the past. I think certainly, though, when you compare him to Howard, when you talk about concern level or, you know, is this guy going to get it back, it's at opposite ends of the spectrum, I would say, because Utley's at least had a little bit better of a recent track record. He's had a little bit better history. You know, he struggled the second half of last year, but when you compare him to other second basemen in baseball, he was still among the top, I think, 7 in OPS, certainly among the top second basemen in the National League. So based off that recent history, which Howard doesn't have, I think everybody in the organization, from everybody that I've talked to, is kind of like, you know what, it's not good, certainly, but we think he's going to get it figured out at some point.
So let's look at something that might actually be good news, and that is that Chad Billingsley seems to be getting closer and closer. 7 strikeouts in 8 1/3 innings in AAA. He's made 2 starts. He's on the way. What are you hearing about how Chad Billingsley is actually looking at AAA?
They seem to be pretty encouraged with what he's done so far. He wasn't real happy with his off-speed stuff, his breaking stuff in his last AAA start. But they're encouraged, and he's going to get 3 more rehab starts before he's expected to join the rotation. Bob McClure, the pitching coach, said at the end of spring training, he's like, he's looked phenomenal. I can't believe this guy had 2 elbow surgeries now. Hey, everybody talks great about everybody in spring training, so who knows exactly how accurate that portrayal is and how accurate it'll be once he actually gets in there against big league pitching. But I think – certainly the best-case scenario is that Chad Billingsley joins the Phillies' rotation in May and pitches very well. I'm not saying, you know, ERA under 3 or anything, but, if he could pitch in the mid-3s, you know, quality starts every time out or near every time out, then they could flip him to another team, maybe get a prospect or two in return. I mean, he's only making $1.5 million this year, so – truthfully, I think that was the reason why they signed him in the first place. They needed depth in the rotation. They didn't have it, but they're like, why don't we take a shot on this guy? Hope he comes back, and if he pitches great, maybe we can trade him to a contender and actually get something for him.
What do they think the upside is? I mean, do they think the upside is a guy who's pretty good at the back of the rotation, or do they think there's some chance that maybe this guy gets close to what he showed flashes of, and he never really made it stick for a long time, but he showed flashes of being probably a number 2 starter in the big league. So they think there's some chance that's still in there, or is that overly optimistic?
I think that's maybe a little bit too overly optimistic, but I do think they view him more as a more than a back of the rotation type guy. I don't think they look at him as a guy where you kind of go, well, if he can give you five or six innings and allow three or four runs, you know, kind of keep our team in a game every time out, not get blown out, you know, we'll take that. So I definitely feel that they think that he can be better than that, but maybe not at that number two type of level.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks for listening.